So we have rapidly reached the end of Habakkuk. This is our third week doing it, final week. And this is an amazing end to the book. I hope you all enjoy this as much as I have. And you don't see that yet, do you?
It is pretty amazing.
Yeah, we can talk about the artistry another time. So starting in verses 1 and 2, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet, according to Shigionoth, Lord, I have heard your report and I fear. O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. So this is, as we look at this, we're going to see that Habakkuk really should have been broken into two chapters. Chapter 1 and 2 is one unit, and chapter 3 is a separate unit. All right, so where in the beginning, in chapter 1, it says an oracle of Habakkuk, now we have the prayer of Habakkuk. All right, so we've it's almost like he started over again. Right, Habakkuk the prophet. And then we've got this, according to Shigionoth, I can't say it. And not only can I say it, I don't know what it means. And neither does anybody else. The best guesses, and these are totally guesses, is that it is either related to music style or poetry style. And it's here saying something about how it's supposed to be read or sung or played. But that's a guess. So we've got this thing that nobody really knows what it means, but it's there. But because I don't know what it means, I'm not even going to try and expound on it. I'm just going to keep going. Lord, I have heard your report and I fear. All right, so here now, this is looking back to chapter 2. Remember, chapter 1 was how long? Chapter 2 is God's answer to how long? And now Habakkuk says, I get it. I heard. And what's his response? Fear. And here, this, I love reading commentary because sometimes people try so hard to make it mean anything other than what it means. The commentaries, I looked at three different commentaries, all of them said, this can't be fear of the Babylonians. It must be fear of the Lord. And they go through and explain why it must be fear of the Lord. It's not the fear of the Lord here. I mean, he's obviously got a very solid dose of fear of the Lord going. We'll see that throughout. But this is not talking about, I've heard your report and I am in great awe of you. And we'll see, this is a prelude to verse 16, because the fear thing stops right here and he doesn't mention it again until verse 16. But this is talking about, I've heard your report, and I'm scared. All right. It says, O Lord, revive your work in the midst of years, in the midst of years make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. So here is his petition, and of course this is good poetry. This is good enough poetry, it even works in English. All right. It says, revive your work in the midst of years. Right. And then the word revive here is revive, renew, to bring back to life or to restore. Right. And so he's saying, Lord, do your mighty things again. And he says, in the midst of years. And the way this works out in Hebrew is kind of interesting. I won't carry it into the English. But it's in the very middle of. Right. And the idea is, don't wait until the years are all done to get around to working. Yeah, cut it short and do it in the middle. Right, don't make us wait till the fullness of time to do this work. So he says, revive your work. God's punishment on Judah is coming. It's going to happen. And don't you two think I won't call on you just because you're in the second row.
I don't know what's going on,
I'm sure. I know. So, but here, Habakkuk is really, he's pleading for a shortened time of chastisement, shortened time of punishment on Judah. He says, don't make us go through the whole thing. All right. It says, revive your work in the middle. In the middle. All right. It says, and then we have that same in the middle, in the midst of years. All right. It says, make it known. All right. Is if you'll think back the different prophets that we've read, one of the themes that seems to carry through is I'm doing this so the world will know who I am. Right. God brought Israel out of Egypt so that the nations would know. Right. We have the whole new covenant so that the nations will know. Right. And here, this is the same thing. It's in the midst of years, make it known. And this is make known who you are. Don't let the world not see. Don't hide this from them as you are cutting your anger short and showing us mercy in the middle. So everybody understands your mercy. Right? And then he says, in wrath, remember mercy. So here he acknowledges God's wrath is coming. It's on its way. It's going to happen. All right? But don't forget mercy. So ultimately, this beginning part here is a petition for mercy. In the punishment's coming. There's no denying it, but please don't go get so wrapped up in your wrath that you forget to be merciful on us. You can see that's in the poetry there, but you can see it. Verses 3-5. God comes from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran, Selah. His splendor covers the heavens, and the earth is full of his praise. His radiance is like the sunlight. He has rays flashing from his hand, and there is the hiding place of his power. Before him goes pestilence, and plague comes after him. Now, this is an interesting stretch here in chapter 3. And it starts right from the beginning. Habakkuk does some strange things. He says, this God comes from Teman. Unfortunately, English, we pretty much have three ways of addressing God. We have Lord, God, and Father. And that's about all we have. In Hebrew, there's a whole scope of different words that are used. And here, this is an uncommon one. The word is Eloah. Eloah. And can anyone tell me where this name is first found in the Bible? I wouldn't expect you to, but it's in Deuteronomy. Right? And as a matter of fact, this sets the tone now for everything that follows. We're going to be going back to Deuteronomy, going back to Moses and Exodus. Right? And Deuteronomy 32, verses 15 and 17, is the first places in the Bible. Not the last, but the first places where God is referred to as Eloah. Now, and that Deuteronomy 32 is the song of Moses. Right? It's kind of his praise summary to the Pentateuch, which is immediately followed by the blessing of Moses. And we'll hit those multiple times. Right? But this, we're doing kind of a dual thing here. He's playing with words. Right? And he has been. He says, God comes from Teman. And this word for God, Eloah, is the same word that he used back in chapter 1, verse 11, when he said, the Babylonians' Eloah is their strength. So here the Babylonians are so wrapped up in how powerful they are. And Habakkuk says, yeah, Eloah is coming. You haven't seen Eloah yet. So he's coming. He's coming from Teman. Do we know where that's at? Probably not. How about the Mount Paran? Anyone know where that's at? You can probably make some good money in archaeology if you do. No, we don't know exactly. We have fairly reasonable guesses, but we don't know exactly where it is. But no, it's a specific place. Teman was in the southeastern part of Edom. We can narrow it down there. And it's named after the grandson of Esau. All right. Mount Paran, as a name, is found only here. And anyone want to guess where else? Deuteronomy 33:2. All right. In the blessing of Moses. All right. So we're going to see Habakkuk is going back and drawing all these ties from Moses. And And the exact location of Mount Paran, again, unknown, but we've got the region of Paran. We know where that was at. All right. But here, these two sites are taken from this blessing of Moses. So Habakkuk's going back to that blessing. He's saying, he's coming. He's coming. He's coming. As he gets closer and closer. All right. And so Deuteronomy 33:2, he said, "The Lord came from Sinai and dawned on them from Seir. He shone forth from Mount Paran. He came from the midst of 10,000 holy ones. At his right hand there was flashing lightning for them." Right, so this is looking back to the glory of God, right? Poetically done by Moses, right, but the glory of God specifically as they're going through the wilderness and the different things that happen in the wilderness after Sinai. So the Lord came from Sinai, right? Dawned on them from Seir. That's another name for Edom, right, Teman. Right, and then shone forth from Paran. So that's following the path of the Lord, so to speak. So here we've got the Babylonians who trust in their Eloah, their strength. And Habakkuk saying, yeah, God's coming. And look how he's coming. Right, so this is recalling the Lord's leading of Israel by fire, by cloud. These visible signs of God's glory over Mount Sinai. Right, verse 4 in Habakkuk 3. Right, verse 4, "His radiance is like sunlight. He has rays flashing from his hand." All right, so this is poetically describing God's power as it was displayed over Mount Sinai. Right, and this is going back to that, keeping going with that allusion back to Deuteronomy. And Habakkuk here tries to put into words what that must have looked like. All right, radiance like sunlight. You know, there's going to be a bunch of like, but the idea is God's glory is bright, it's brilliant. Rays in his hand. So, of course, we've got anthropomorphism, using human anatomy to describe God. Right, but, again, the idea is that there's this brilliance of God's glory. And then we have the hiding of God's power. Right, and alluding to that cloud that hid the mountain so that the people couldn't see, but you sure didn't want to step on that mountain, or you would feel God's power. It would be the last thing you feel. But so here this is looking at Mount Sinai. And here we have Habakkuk. Right, now, so there's definite allusion here to fear of the Lord. Habakkuk has a strong respect and awe for God. And he says, "Before him goes pestilence, and plague comes after him." So now, if we're talking about Moses and the things that Moses is remembering in his song and his blessing, what's this talking about? The plagues in Egypt. All right, now, at this point in time when Moses had written, 10 plagues of Egypt would be behind him. All right. What went before him? Oh, might there be a conquest or three or four coming up? All right, we've got we've got the Moabites, Amorites, that's the name I'm trying to come up with. Amorites, Midianites, Canaanites. So the Lord goes and people fall dead. All right, that's the picture here. You can follow the Lord's path by dead people behind him, and you can see where he's going as people fall dead before him. All right, pestilence and plague, these are unstoppable death. All right, in this period of time, there was nothing to stop a plague, to keep a plague from spreading, unless you have a priest who runs out there and stands in between the plague and the people. Right, we remember that happening. Right, so, but there's then also the illusion of God's judgment on Israel, right, which happened by way of plague, a time of three that we saw in Numbers. Okay, so here we see all of this bound up in poetry. Poetry is beautiful. Poetry is wonderful. What all it can convey. So here is Habakkuk is looking back to Moses. He's talking about the great and mighty things that God has done. And there's this shadow of Babylon sitting behind all this. If this is what God did to the Egyptians, just you wait. He's coming. Verses 6 and 7. He stood and surveyed the earth. He looked and made nations tremble. Yes, the perpetual mountains were shattered. The ancient hills collapsed. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Cushan under distress. The tent curtains of the land of Midian were trembling. So, poetically speaking, Habakkuk now anticipates a time when the Lord is no longer coming. He's arrived. All right. And the word stood here means to firmly plant oneself. This is kind of a military term of, I'm going to stand here and you aren't going to get past me. All right. So the Lord plants himself, looks across the earth. As he looks, nations tremble. And here the word tremble is it moves, shakes side to side. And so there's this contrast in between God who's firmly planted and the nations that can't hold still. Right? They're shaking, quaking in their boots in their fear of God. So this talks about the worldwide dominion of God, because God looks across the whole earth and all of the earth fears. The nations can see the imminence of God's wrath. Yes, the perpetual mountains were shattered. The ancient hills collapsed. His ways are everlasting. So here there's this contrast between creation, which even, you know, mountains and hills, you think of them as really long duration. And Habakkuk says, mountains come to an end. Right. As a matter of fact, some mountains come to a very abrupt end. Some hills come to a very abrupt end. And this is God's power, but God doesn't come to an abrupt end. He's perpetual. The perpetual mountains that come to an end, no, God is everlasting. He's unchanging. Now, this description is really similar to what we saw just a few weeks ago back in Nahum chapter 1. There, the description of God's power and wrath. Mountains quake because of him, and the hills dissolve. Indeed, the earth is upheaved by his presence. The world and all the inhabitants in it, who can stand before his indignation? Who can endure the burning of his anger? His wrath is poured out like fire, and the rocks are broken up by him. So you can see the similarity there. So even those aspects of creation that are shown to be impermanent, and that's contrasting with God's eternality. He says, I saw the tents of Cushan under distress. And the name Cushan is only used here in one other place. And it's a poetic reference to, guess? Anyone? Egypt, yes. So we've got Egypt and Midian. Now, we know about the Egypt. What's the Midian thing? Why would the Midianites be...
They were the ones that wanted to kill them right before they went into the land.
And how did they do that in particular? Do you remember?
They set harlots.
Yeah, it was the Balaam incident part two. Okay, so again, you know, pestilence behind, plague ahead, or maybe I got those backwards. But all right. So this is returning to that theme of the Exodus. All right, and the Egyptians were distressed. Maybe a plague or ten. We've got the Midianites who are hiding in their tents, right? And they're so scared that their tents are shaking. So here we have, and Habakkuk speaks as if he is a firsthand witness to these things. And some theologians posit that as this is going through, this is describing a second vision of Habakkuk. And it may be. I don't know. But the Midianites cursed Israel, and yeah, they bore God's wrath. All right, so these are recalling the past works of the Lord in redeeming and protecting his people, places where God has made the nation see who he is. Remember Habakkuk, it says, revive your work in the middle. Right, do things like this again, just don't make us wait all the way to the end. Did the Lord rage against the rivers, or was your anger against the rivers? Or was your wrath against the sea that you rode on your horses, on your chariots of salvation? Your bow was made bare, the rods of chastisement were sworn, Selah. All right, so here Habakkuk frames three parallel rhetorical questions, and they all revolve around water and angry. All right, we've got the two different terms that regarding water. We've got river and sea, and then we've got angry. We've got rage, anger, wrath. Whoever did this translation did a good job of trying to carry that poetry across. So Habakkuk is asking God, he says, were those demonstrations of power because you were mad with creation? Were you angry with the water? Now, what are we talking about here? When has God shown his power over water during the time of Moses? Parting of the Red Sea? What else? That might be. There's three references here. Most people can only come up with two reasons, but that may very well be the third one. Pardon me? Actually, what were you starting to say before then?
When they were going into the Promised Land.
Yes, crossing the Jordan. All right. So God did this to the sea. God pushed back the Jordan, and the blood may very well be that third reference to the river. All right. So here we have God's power on display, impacting creation. And the rhetorical question, were you mad at creation? No. But God was doing these mighty works on behalf of his people, to redeem his people, to fulfill his promises to his people. So God is willing to move, if you will, heaven and earth for his people. And he says, that you rode on your horses, on your chariots of salvation. So this is shifting now. It pictures the Lord as the commander of armies. And these are the armies of salvation. All right, this is God's armies saving Israel. So, and this begins a series of listings of different weapons, the weapons of God, starting with chariots. So, on your chariots of salvation, he says, your bow was made bare. All right, and this is talking about getting the bow out of the sheath and getting it ready, stringing it so it's ready to go, ready to fire. All right, so, you have prepared to fire. He says, the rods of chastisement were sworn. Here, the word here for rod or staff, it just means a staff. And it can be, there's a whole scope of different uses of staff. We've got Aaron's staff, Moses' staff, this word here. All right, you've got the staff of rulers, their symbol of their office. Here, this is talking about the staff that's used for beating someone who is out of line. All right, punishment of a criminal. All right, and so your rods of chastisement, it says, were sworn. Right, and here this is, again, looking back to, anyone? Guess? Not Egypt. Where has he been quoting from and alluding to? Deuteronomy 32, verses 40 to 43. It says, indeed, I lift up my hand to heaven, and I say, this is God speaking, and I say, as I live forever, if I sharpen my flashing sword, and my hand takes hold on justice, I will render vengeance on my adversaries, and I will repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword will devour flesh, with the blood of the slain and of the captives, from the long-haired leader of the enemy. Rejoice, O nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants, and will render vengeance on his adversaries, and will atone for his land and his people. So this is Moses writing in this song. And this is what Habakkuk is looking back to. He says, the rods of chastisement are sworn. This is looking at God's oath upon himself. As long as, and I say, as I live forever. So God makes a promise. This is what I'm going to do. Right? And so that's what Habakkuk here is looking back to. Is God's promise to bring vengeance on his enemies and on those who have persecuted his people. You cleaved the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and quaked. The downpour of water swept by. The deep uttered forth its voice. It lifted high its hands. Sun and moon stood in their places. They went away at the light of your arrows, at the radiance of your gleaming spear. Now, when he says you cleave the earth with rivers, this is ambiguous. It's hard to point back to exactly where Habakkuk is looking back to, but this may very well be the point where Moses slammed his stick into a rock and water burst forth. All right, it says, the mountains saw you and quaked. The downpour of water swept by. Again, we go back to this idea of mountains that tremble. All right, but now we have this idea of mountains. You expect them to be solid, unmoving. All right, but these mountains squirm and writhe at the power of the Lord. All right, and the downpour here is probably an allusion to Noah's flood. Again, thinking of the mighty acts that God has done. The deep uttered forth its voice and lifted high its hands. What are we talking about here? You would, with the term deeps, you would think, but it's not. When did the water lift forth its hands? Nope. What happens when the water goes? Crossing the Red Sea. As a matter of fact, here, because Habakkuk really likes Moses, he goes back to Psalm 77, 16 to 19. The waters saw you, O God. The waters saw you and they were in anguish. The deeps also trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth a sound. You think he was talking about Noah here, but he's not. Your arrows flashed here and there. The sound of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea and your path in the mighty waters. Your footprints may not be known. And that's actually a psalm about Moses and the parting of the Red Sea. All right? Very magnificent, almost bombastic language here, talking about the parting of the Red Sea. All right? So that's the same kind of language that Habakkuk is using now. Going back to that. He does. He hits it over and over again. All right. So here, this is poetic idea of the sound of the Red Sea as it was split. And, I don't know what happens when you move that much water that quickly, but maybe there was a sound, or maybe it was the sound of the wind. We have this anthropomorphism of the deeps raising their hands. So you start at the bottom of the sea and it raises up its hands and everything goes back. And he says, sun and moon stood in their places. They went away at the light of your arrows, at the radiance of your gleaming spear. So here we have even the dominance of the Lord over the sun and the moon, things that other nations kind of tend to worship. And God speaks and they stop moving. All right, where have we heard that before?
Joshua.
All right. Joshua 10, 12, and 13. Then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, O sun, stand still at Gibeon, and O moon in the valley of Ajalon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged himself of their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jashar? And the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. So here, this is again alluding to the mighty work that God had done on behalf of his people. Verses 12 and 13. In indignation you marched through the earth. In anger you trampled the nations. You went forth for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You struck the head of the house of evil to lay him open from thigh to neck, Selah. So in indignation, you march through the earth. In anger, you trample the nations. So this is still looking back at the Exodus, thinking about the trip from Egypt to Israel. How many nations survived that trip, aside from Israel? Not too many. Anyone that tended to say no and got in their way, got a little flicked aside or step and squish. Right. Nations didn't survive that trip. So and remember, the Lord went before Israel. So the idea is Israel is just following in the wake of God's path. Right. So this is as if God were some giant stepping across the earth, and nations just happen to get crushed each time his foot comes down. And these are destroyed as a result of God's vengeance. It says, you went forth for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. So this angry rampage, if you will, has a purpose. All right? This isn't just wanton chaos. All right? This is for the salvation of Israel. It says, for your people. This is what God did to save Israel. Now, this is not talking eternal salvation. This is talking redeeming them from Egypt, bringing them out of Egypt and into the promised land. Now, that salvation of Israel then is given another parallel. And we're going to have to stop here for a moment. It says the salvation of your anointed, or literally your anointed one. Now, if you go back and you look through the Pentateuch, and you look up anointed, who's anointed in the Pentateuch? Priests. You got some sacrificial kind of stuff that are given anointings, and that's it. He's been drawing a lot from the Pentateuch, but this isn't Pentateuch language. As a matter of fact, the word here is, and anyone know the Hebrew word here?
Probably.
Messiah.
I was going to say, in my translation, it's a big A. So I kept looking at your A like, nah.
This is the word Messiah. All right, and here, if you really want to not look forward to the New Testament, he has to at least be talking about the line of David, the anointed one. All right, but that's if you really want to close those blinders and not look forward. He's talking about the Messiah. All right. Remember, this is Habakkuk. He's had a long history already of messianic promise, right, that he's already heard. And so this puts a really different angle on everything that we know about the Exodus, about the Promised Land. It wasn't just God saving Israel for the people of that day. God had to act on Israel's behalf because of who would come out of Israel later. If God didn't deliver Israel from Egypt, there would be no Messiah. So God had to act. God had to save Israel, because in doing so, he was in essence saving the Messiah. Now, how's that for a nice little bit of prophetic theology there? So he says, you struck the head of the house of evil to lay him over from thigh to neck. So this is continuing the poetic description of God's wrath and his conquest, including the execution of the Egyptian head of state. Right? And here he's described as the head of the house of evil. So who's the house of evil? Egypt. And God has executed the head of state. And here, pardon me if I geek out for just a minute on this piece here. This is talking about God's justice in action. This description here, lay him open from thigh to neck, it's a little graphic. All right? But this is straight up describing a death blow from a sword. This is a swordsman's strike, but this isn't just any swing of the sword. This is particularly done from a draw. And the idea is draw up, and your opponent's dead. So it's going from standing in a no-fight position to you're dead, with nothing in between. All right, God has gone from peace to execution. And how many strikes does the Pharaoh get in? None. He's done before he knows it. All right, so this is talking about God's defeat of Nebuchadnezzar. Of course, God didn't cut him open. He got crushed and drowned. But the idea is that this was an execution. The parting of the Red Sea had a dual function. It was saving the people, but it was also God's execution on Nebuchadnezzar. He was evil, and God says, "You're done." And he had no appeal. He had no way to fight back. And when God says, "You're done," you're done. Verse 14. You pierced with his own spears the head of his throngs. They stormed in to scatter us. Their exultation was like those who devour the oppressed in secret. You trampled on the sea with your horses, on the surge of many waters. So here Habakkuk describes the Lord's defeat of the Egyptians as using their own weapons against them. All right, and this continues the litany of weapons of the Lord. All right, he says, you pierced with his own spears the head of his throng. So the idea is, you took his weapon away from him and you ran him through with it. You killed him with his own stuff. All right. And he says, they stormed in to scatter us. Their exultation was like those who devour the oppressed in secret. So they were coming, they were riding in like a band of bandits. All right. And you dealt with them like a band of bandits. You killed them. So this continues what we saw last week in Habakkuk 2 with this idea of symmetrical justice. They brought it on themselves. They had it coming. Right? And with the Egyptians, they brought it on themselves. They had it coming. They wouldn't have been swept away at the Red Sea if they hadn't been there to try and scatter Israel. And the idea here is a chariot charge that leaves the opponents scattered because they can't stand against it. Well, if they hadn't done it, they wouldn't have been crushed. All right, and again, we get back to the Red Sea. Yes, he really likes the Red Sea thing. And he says, you trampled on the sea with your horses, on the surge of many waters. So we've done plenty of parting. Now we have the coming back. Right? And the idea is God jumped on it a couple times for good measure to make sure you got it all tamped down. So this is what God did to Egypt. Remember, all this, we got always, you can't, as you read through, you can't forget that Babylon is sitting in the background. Right, Babylon is waiting, and Habakkuk is just running through this poetic litany of things that God has done. Oh, and you're next. You're next. And here, there has been this almost overbearing emphasis on water. I can't help but wonder if there isn't this little bit of prophetic foreshadowing here, because how did the Medes get into Babylon? They dammed up the Euphrates River and they walked through on dry riverbed. Right, so I kind of wonder if there is a little bit more going on here, is hinting at what's going to happen. In verses 16 and 17, getting back to verse 1 and 2, I heard and my inward parts trembled. At the sound my lips quivered. Decay entered my bones, and in my place I tremble, because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people to arise who will invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail, and the fields of produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold, and there be no cattle in the stalls. So here Habakkuk, all that bit on Moses and the parting of the Red Sea and everything else that happened, that's kind of an interlude. Right? And he gets back to verse 2 and he says, I'm afraid. I have heard your report and I'm afraid. Right? I heard and I my inward parts trembled. To the sound, my lips quivered. And this is the physical symptoms, if you will, of terror. Right? Decay enters my bones. Right? In my place, I tremble. He is scared. And like this is the part where so many commentators want to say, well, he's just in complete overwhelming, almost ecstasy at the magnitude of the vision he has just seen. They keep trying to focus and channel it down that, and that's not what's going on here. He's scared. In the way that we think of scared, terror. All right. He says, because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people to arise who will invade us. Now, I'll admit the Hebrew here is a little difficult. But he is looking forward now to the invasion of Babylon, the Babylonians coming into Judah. Remember what chapter 1 was about. He says, how long are you going to put up with the evil and the violence and the wickedness of Judah? Oh, but how long are the Babylonians going to run around and munch on different nations? He didn't like the fact that Judah was not behaving the way God's people were supposed to behave, but it was even worse that God, you know, looking at the fact God was going to use a horrible, evil, wicked people to do really nasty things to Judah. Right? And now he went from, "How long, O Lord?" to, "I must wait quietly." He knows now. He understands. He doesn't like it, but he understands. There will be no more complaints from Habakkuk. Remember, he said in chapter 2, it begins with, "I'm waiting for my rebuke. I know I'm in trouble. I'm waiting for my correction. So I'm standing here waiting for it." And now he says, I'm going to wait in silence for the Babylonians, for the people to arise who will invade us. If we were to stop there, that would be a really depressing end to Habakkuk. It would make sense. God says, "You're going to get punished." He says, "Okay, I'm going to sit here and wait for it. I'm going to take it." Right? But it doesn't end there. He says, "Though the fig tree should not blossom and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold and there be no cattle in the stall." Right? This is famine language. Right? And particularly when the Babylonians come through, what they don't eat, they kill. And the few people that manage to survive the invasion probably won't survive the famine that follows the invasion. And he said, even though this should be the situation, it's not going to crush his spirit. Matter of fact, verse 18 says, "Yet I will exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he has made my feet like hinds' feet and will make me walk on my high places." For the choir director on my stringed instruments. All right, there's a little musical conclusion there. But even in the face of what's to come, the horror of the conquest of the hands of those brutal Babylonians, because remember, they weren't any nicer than the people of Nineveh that they replaced. All right. Habakkuk says, "I'm going to exult in the Lord." And exaltation here is this irrepressible, fierce joy. He's scared. Nobody's interested in living through what the Babylonians are bringing on. But he has joy. He has great joy. And what's the object of his joy? God. God. He says, now, God is the source of salvation, but the focus is on God, who God is. Remember, he said, "Let the nations know," but he knows. Right? He's just given himself a reminder of who God is. All right. So this looks forward past the times of distress that God has promised to the deliverance of Judah from the Babylonians. There will be a time when these things will happen to Babylon, when the God who wiped out the Egyptians, wiped out the Canaanites, God's already said, "You're done." God is going to save Israel again. But even as things look their worst, notice what Habakkuk holds on to. It's not just faith. The faith is there. But his attitude is rejoicing. What was his attitude when we began?
How long?
He was complaining. He was unhappy. He didn't like the way things looked. So we go from complaint to joy. Irrepressible, unstoppable joy. He says, "The Lord God is my strength. He has made my feet like hinds' feet. He makes me walk on my high places." So here, the Lord is the one that he relies on. The Lord is the one who powers Habakkuk, if you will. And this echoes the song of Moses, of course. Goes back to Exodus 15, 2 and 3. And Habakkuk closes with this simile, comparing himself to a deer. I don't quite get the deer connection, but the idea is where previously his legs trembled, right, in his terror, now they have the strength and the sure-footedness of a deer. He's not scared in that respect. He's rejoicing in the Lord. He doesn't like how it looks. It's going to be bad. It's going to be really bad. But he has confidence in the Lord. He rejoices in the Lord. So there's this, in the midst of the evil coming on, the bad stuff coming, we have courage because of God. Now that is a high note to end the book on, and we'll close in prayer there. Our Father, we thank you for who you are, for the magnificence of your character, for all that you have laid before us in who you are and what you have done for your people. Father, I pray that we too would share Habakkuk's joy and exultation in who you are. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen.